am, of course, Dr. Rob Farley of the Patterson School of Diplomacy and International Commerce. With me today is Dr. Colin Snyder. I'll let him introduce himself again in just a second. But before I do that, I wanted to challenge everyone to identify the hat that I'm wearing. There is no prize money. There's no prize for identifying it. But if you can identify the hat, and if you can identify the era that the hat came from, I will indicate that I'm duly impressed in comments. Anyway, on matters not nearly as light. Well, first, Colin, why don't you introduce yourself?
Hi, I'm Colin Snyder. I'm a professor of history at the University of Texas Tyler with a specialization in Latin American history. I also blog at America's South and North, and I'm hatless today.
Yeah, we will have a link to America's South and North, and we'll also have a few other links. So what we're talking about today we're basically using the recent conviction of a former Guatemalan dictator of genocide. Convicted, as I understand, by a Guatemalan court. And we are going to talk about Guatemala specifically. We're going to talk about sort of broader issues in the Cold War in Latin America. We're going to talk about U.S. culpability. Then we're going to talk a little bit about the transition, the democratic transitions that have happened in Latin America and sort of what this means for them and so forth. And then we may at the end be able to talk a little bit about whether there is potentially some rollback in Latin America, such as in Honduras or Paraguay. So I guess, starting us off, Colin, what just happened in Guatemala?
Well, they had a conclusion. It was a very long and winding trial, so we can perhaps get into that a bit. It wasn't long. It was very winding, though. That the former president of Guatemala and head of the military, Efraín Ríos Montt, who served from about April of 82 to August or so of 83, give or take a month in there, had been put on trial for human rights violations and for genocide. And it's that second point that's really key here, because no Latin American president or former dictator had been ever charged with genocide before. Human rights violations and convictions for violations we'd seen in the past, but never for genocide. And additionally, it's notable on an international scale because no former leader had been charged with genocide within his national courts, that you'd had charges of genocide, but they'd generally been heard in places like The Hague or the Nuremberg trials, whereas this was within the national court system. And so you had a very complicated trial in which one judge had been removed from the case and then was reinstated, and she said it had to be set back to November of 2011, effectively, pre-trial stages. Even as it was close to its end, another judge on the tribunal said that that's nonsense and overruled it. The Constitutional Court temporarily ruled in her favor. The trial ended yesterday. That Ríos Montt gave an address before the court on Thursday and spoke for the first time on it, really, in about 30 years. And the court found yesterday then that he was guilty of genocide, particularly against the Ixil peoples, right? That this is what's sort of at the crux of this murder of 1,771 Ixil Maya, who had been targeted in this scorched earth campaign between 82 and 83, and that Guatemala had been involved in the civil war, and we can come back to the history here later, but that there's sort of been political instability slash civil war since a coup that the United States sponsored in 1954. That's really in the 80s that you have the most intense repression, that upwards of at least, you have about 200,000 dead in the course of the Civil War and another 50,000 disappeared. And in 1982 alone, you have about 75,000 of those 200,000 are killed. So that really a large onus of the human rights violations falls on the years immediately before, during, and after Ríos Montt. So regarding the guerrillas, that they had wanted to target, mobilize amongst indigenous communities, that you have this sort of belief that the ideals of agrarian reform are certainly going to resonate with these indigenous people. And also the fact that you have this very, really dating back to the colonial era, this targeting of indigenous groups and this marginalization of indigenous groups, that the guerrillas' messages would really resonate with these people. And so there were efforts for the guerrillas to work among some of these communities, but by and large, I'll put it this way, that the communities that are targeted are in no way in proportion to those working with the guerrillas. That you might have a couple of people in one community on one side of a mountain, sympathizing with guerrillas or carrying some of their material, even fighting with them. But that would still lead to the military going after an indigenous community on the opposite side of the mountain, just sort of this guilt by association thing, right? that they say you basically have to, and even after they sort of launch this scorched earth tactics, it's still pretty brutal that they basically go for a carrot and stick approach where they say, we'll kill 30% of the population and reward the other 70% for not working with them. Which is a really bold statement, right? That your government is, I mean, you know, it's to sort of put, I mean, not that there's any parallels to the present, but imagine if the United States government today said, we're setting out to kill 30% of the people and we'll reward the other 70%, and all of a sudden you have 90 million people who are the target of repression. So, that's sort of the government's approach, but it's, again, it's a very disproportionate response that you have this rhetoric, and we can come back to this maybe later, the philosophical debate over both sides do it, right? Because certainly the guerrillas are committing violence, but the proportions of guerrilla violence compared to state violence against civilian communities, and again, they're not just targeting these, you know, say civilian or indigenous communities, but that means children, right? That one, right after Reagan praises Rios Montt, you have the Dos Edes massacre, in which around a little over 120 people are killed in a village, and over 60 of them are children under the age of 12. So it's things like, and this is so grotesque, but swinging babies through the air and slamming their heads against the wall. And so that's sort of, you know, obviously a four-year-old is not going to be terribly sympathetic to a guerrilla cause because it doesn't understand the finer niceties of Marxist ideology and land reform. Right? These are not in the four-year-old's universe. So there's an effort to target indigenous communities, but the state response in no way reflects the support for guerrillas within those communities.
Right. Now, what were the politics of Guatemala like after 1990 such that it took, maybe you could say just a little bit about the 30 years between now and Rios Montt's tenure. I mean, so how, you suggested it's a long winding road for this trial. I mean, how did it come to the point where they felt they were able to try him, that people decided that they wanted to try him? You know, to what extent are there still sympathizers for his position within Guatemala that you know of?
Well, okay, so that's the complicated question, because the military gets over, you know, isn't in power anymore, well, except for the current president, but we can come back to him, because he's ex-military and sort of implicated in this genocidal process himself. But it doesn't really disrupt the social structures, that the hierarchies that were in place before the Civil War remain in place afterwards. The politics continues to be dominated by the landed elite. This, you know, there's a huge gap between the rich and the poor, in terms of land distribution, in terms of income, in terms of influence over politics, and that's a process that goes back to the colonial period once again, that's not a necessarily recent innovation of capitalism per se, and that, so they really have remained in office, and yeah, that Rios Montt does have a sense of support, that the judicial system itself is kind of, not to put too fine a point on it, but a mess, that it had never represented anyone really but the elites in the first place, and certainly 36 years of civil war isn't going to lead to any sense of institutional strength. So that it was really difficult, and it really takes the pressure from outside groups to try to force this issue. And you do have indigenous activists within Guatemala as well, right? That Rigoberto Menchú is the most famous of these. And that eventually they're finally able to, I don't know exactly the niceties of how the trial arrived to where it was, that you'd started to have this, it was sort of a very slow moving, that what has just happened in the last 3 months is really the culmination of years of efforts to try to document this genocide. Like I said, that if the one judge had had her way, Judge Patricia Flores, it would have been set back to the pre-trial date before all the testimony was gathered, and that was in November of 2011. So that this has really taken a long time, even though we've known since 1996 with the Truth Commission, it basically argued that, yes, genocide took place here. And there's also just a sense of intimidation that you haven't seen go away yet, that there's a, I believe it's in Guatemala, I hope I'm not speaking here, but, you know, one guy issues a report of a priest, and he's bludgeoned to death in 99 with a cinder block in his garage 2 days after this report's been announced. And even yesterday in the courtroom, people who weren't with the press were filming these indigenous people celebrating, and there was, you know, people who were witnessing this said that there's a very strong sense that this might be used to intimidate these indigenous people later. So that there are really a lot of social, hierarchical, and institutional roadblocks that it's kind of amazing this got pulled off, and I don't think this process is over. That, oh, well, he's sentenced to jail for 80 years. I would at best put it 50-50 that he finishes his life in jail. I mean, I don't think that's really the marker of this, is that he's going to rot in jail till he's dead. But he will be fighting legal battles till he's dead, because the appeals process, even if he's released on a technicality, which judges have the power to do in Guatemala, they can act pretty, it's a pretty heterogeneous and I don't want to quite say corrupt, but the abuse for power is pretty strong there. That there's not a lot of checks on judicial authority. So that another judge could set him out without any problem, but that you'll always have this appeals process, and that he's been tainted by this conviction forever.
Right. So how old is he, by the way?
He is 86.
86, okay. So, right, so he's essentially... I mean, we're not looking at a very long lifespan in the future, right? Even if he spend the rest of his life in prison.
But I think, if I can interrupt you, I think a good useful parallel is Pinochet, right? Because Pinochet was actually never even indicted for anything, but that you have this incident in London in 98, and then he goes back to Chile, and by 2000, they're starting to move against him, and by the early 2000s, he's under house arrest. They're bringing forth charges that he's, or he's indicted, but I don't believe he's never convicted, right? He never goes to court, but he remains under house arrest the rest of his life. You can continue to get revelations. They're indicting him for human rights violations. They're indicting him for the murders of people, that they're connecting him to embezzlement and corruption, which really puts a dent in his support because he had always prided himself on being the incorruptible man who sacrificed everything for his nation. And he dies in 2006 without facing trial, but the last 4 or 5 years, and really going back to 98, with the London incident, he's fighting legally for the rest of his life. And so no matter what, I think in the worst case scenario for justice, best case scenario for Rios Montt, that's what he's facing.
Right. So, now the way you describe the Guatemalan Civil War, and I think that this, you know, what this means for Guatemala also applies to the rest of Latin America. You know, that obviously the United States had a role in 1954 in terms of firing up the Civil War. At the same time, we're also talking about broader pressures, not just in Guatemala, but in Latin American society, sort of class pressures, ethnic pressures, that become sort of mapped on to the Civil War and to other civil conflicts in Latin America during the Cold War. Mm-hmm. Now, U.S. policy towards Guatemala varied quite a lot during the 54 to 90 period, to my understanding, right? That, and especially you have a significant difference between the Carter administration, which put quite a lot of pressure on Guatemala, not too much success, to my understanding, and the Reagan administration, which was far more willing to embrace the regime as part of its Latin American Cold War strategy. I guess when I think about that, and maybe you can tell me like how Latin American scholars think about that and so forth, you know, how much does that variation matter to actual outcomes in Guatemala, right? I mean, is there just sort of baseline understanding that the United States, even during the Carter administration, is pursuing the Cold War, and so that certain measures that are used against the Guatemalan left and indigenous people are going to be acceptable? And so, you know, U.S. administrations are simply operating within a fairly narrow band of support for repressive regimes, or... is it your understanding and sort of more broadly understanding that there is this real difference in American policy across the Cold War, that different administrations really do come at this differently?
I mean, I think it's sort of the universal political spectrum. You could say there's not a lot of variation, but that if this was just ideology, that'd be fine. But that this, you know, these ideologies have very real impacts. So that I think the distinction, you know, that Rios Montt himself made no secret of the fact at the time in the 80s, this isn't him sort of looking back and trying to shift blame, that in 82, 83, he's saying how helpful the U.S. and Israeli aid, be it in arms or training, has been to stamping out communism. And that's simply something that has not happened under Carter, right? That kind of aid isn't arriving. You don't have that kind of... And this is another problem, and we could possibly come back to Bannon with this. The emphasis on the United States is a bit problematic because I think it doesn't deny the agency of the leaders, but it sort of diminishes their own autonomy in these actions, right? That you have Rios Montt come to power and basically realize... if I say, you know, raise the specter of communism with this new guy, I can get more help. And you see this also in Nicaragua with the Contras. You see this in El Salvador with the military there, that they don't even sometimes believe that they're facing communists, but they know if they tell the United States this, they can get what they want from the U.S. So I think you sort of have this confluence with Reagan coming to office and then Rios Montt realizing the landscape and asking for this aid, knowing he's probably going to get it. And again, it's not just the United States, it's from Israel. So that, you know, is Carter that radically different from Reagan? And yes, Carter talks the talk about human rights, but he certainly doesn't apply it equally across the board throughout the world. But I still think that the distinction between, and this isn't to vilify one or praise the other, but that the debate over the you know, it's sort of the Bush-Gore debate. Like, the debates over was it really that big a difference? Well, perhaps not in sort of, you know, this isn't a fundamental ideological shift or envision of the role of the United States in the world. But when you get, you know, ask those 1,771 people for whom Rios-Montt was convicted yesterday if that made a big difference, and the answer is absolutely yes.
Right, right, okay. Right, I mean, is that, and so, I mean, I guess this distinction is, well, I mean, because it, I mean, there are additional complications, right, just, I mean, to the extent you just mentioned, too, right, that that Reagan faced a different environment in Latin America, a different ideological, at least thought he faced a different ideological environment in Latin America than Carter did, right, with the with the victory of the Sandinistas in Nicaragua, where it, you know, it appears if you want to squint hard enough that, that and if you believe in domino theory, that, you know, Nicaraguan Sandinistas with support of the Cubans, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, may be able to roll up the Central American countries and so forth, right? Or at least, to my recollection, these kinds of arguments were made, right?
Or rival the Panama Canal, which is another big issue.
Right, right, right. And so, you know, the situation for Carter was different, and we don't know sort of how events, well, the Sandinistas come to power in what, 79, 80? I can't remember exactly.
Sandinistas, yeah, enter into 79.
Yes, in 79. And so, I mean, the Carter is still is putting pressure on the Guatemalan regime in 78, or at least some pressure on the Guatemalan regime in 78 and before. But, you know, we don't fully know, right, if you know, say that Carter had won the presidency in 1980, what his Latin American policy would have looked like, given what was, at least to American Cold Warriors, a more threatening environment in Latin America, right? I mean, he himself might have become more hardline. You know, at the same time, maybe that pressure would have worked, right? And that pressure would have eased the war and would have reduced support for guerrillas, right? This is also something you should be taken seriously.
Yes.
That butchering villages is not normally something associated with coming to any sort of, you know, with the popularity of the government. But, but so the transition, so the Guatemala gets a civilian president in 86, right? And from there, and the war ends in 90, and so from there, sort of Guatemala becomes part of this broader Latin American transition to democracy that we see in, you know, we see from the 80s forward,
right?
Right? And so the Cold War certainly, at least as a political scientist would phrase it, the Cold War certainly matters, seems to matter a lot for regime type in Latin America, right? Mm-hmm. For the victories of certain kinds of regimes. And where was I going with that? I mean, I guess, how universal was this end of Cold War transition in Latin America? What were the first ones, and what were the first movers, and what were the last movers? And sort of what explains why some were first and some were last? Yeah, yeah.
So, I mean, I guess, and this is actually, this dovetails nicely with our last talk. The first, first really big shit, well, I mean, you have the Sandinistas in 79.
Right.
And that you sort of then get this government, but then they're torn apart quickly by civil war, and it sort of takes on this, it's almost like the second act of Cold War in the 80s, right? Mm-hmm. That you sort of look at, there's like, or even third act, like sort of 45 to 59 with Cuba, 59 to Carter, and then Reagan to the end. And, so you have Argentina, which is why this dovetails nicely, that Argentina falls in 83, that the military leaves power after the Malvinas disgrace, the Falklands disgrace there, and rising inflation and some other problems. Brazil transitions to democracy in 85, and that's a weird one because the military pretty much controls that exit entirely, and it's an indirectly elected president in 85. Mm-hmm. The Congress elects the opposition candidate, but it's indirect elections. If you have your first popular election in 89, he takes office in 90, has to resign for corruption in 92. So that you really only have your first transition, peaceful transition from one president to another in 2002. Chile is in 1990 when Pinochet leaves power after failing plebiscite in 88. El Salvador's civil war ends in 92. By 90, the Sandinistas are out of power in Nicaragua. Stroessner's out of power in Paraguay in 89. Uruguay's dictatorship ends in 84, 85, depending on how you count.
Right.
But it's not a perfect matchup either, because you have Peru sort of moving towards it, right? That you have this civil war erupting between the Shining Path, the Marxist Shining Path, this very Maoist Marxist Shining Path, in the 80s as it's transitioning. It goes from a military government to a civilian government in 80, but they say you need a full-blown revolution, and this is bourgeois democracy, that they're challenging, they're operating in the highlands of Peru, and you have paramilitary groups and death squads cracking down in the 80s, and then you get Alberto Fujimori elected in the 90s, and he sort of extends executive power, and, you know, he's in jail now himself for human rights violations. So even though this is democratization outside the Cold War, it is moving, it's not exactly democratization in a perfect sense. Go ahead.
Right. Let me pause you there, because I'm actually very curious about, the relationship of the Shining Path with other Latin American leftist guerrilla indigenous rural movements. And I'm particularly interested in the context of competition between of Sino-Soviet competition, the Shining Path is sort of, I think, you know, the big example of a foreign leftist organization that was quite clearly adhering to the Chinese model, was at least explicitly adhering to the Chinese model.
Yeah.
But, you know, in places like Guatemala and a lot of other places, in places like Guatemala and some other places, the guerrilla movements you see emerging, you know, even if, and I mean, this is something you obviously know much more about than I do, even if they are sort of more directly supplied and more directly influenced by the Soviet Union or the Soviet Union through Cuba, the environment that they're operating in seems much more appropriate to a sort of Chinese form of vision of revolution, right? Was there ever any tension between these two kind of different visions of Marxist revolution? Or, you know, sort of as you suggested earlier, you know, in a lot of cases, were the rebellious organizations and the rebellious people, the rebels, sort of simply taking advantage of communism because it was something ready set of available tropes that could win support and could also win opposition. And so that didn't really animate these movements in any sort of ideological way, but were rather driven by ethnic tension, class conflict, so forth.
Yeah, I'm inclined to say that they are more... I think the Shining Path would be most clearly drawing on international models, right? And even them, they're really adapting Maoism to a particularly Peruvian case, and they never number more than several thousand. At their height, they're several thousand, right? But they try to appeal to the... Like the guerrillas in Guatemala, they're trying to appeal to indigenous peoples in the highlands, but it doesn't really have much success. I would say it's not so much a question of doctrinaire communism or dogmatism on the part of guerrilla groups, that you certainly have communist elements and that they're appealing to some of these ideals, but that it really is grounded, in particularly in the case of Guatemala, but not even limited there, that it's grounded in their national histories and their national historical contingencies. So the Guatemalan guerrillas, again, back to the overthrow of Arbenz, that Arbenz is, if I could sidetrack here really quickly to history, the main offense Arbenz had committed was that he said he wanted to expropriate lands that weren't in use. And he would repay you the value you claimed they were worth. And the United Fruit Company is furious at this because they basically use their connections to the elites to dodge taxes. So he says, so United Fruit Company will pay you $600,000 for this fallow land that you claim, and all of a sudden it's worth $15 million. And they get the CIA to move against him, and they overthrow him. But it was this idea of just, like, trying to redistribute. And Arbenz even expropriates his own land, that he gives rid of some of his own land that he owns to land redistribution because he falls within the parameters of these land reform decrees. And if you own less than 700 acres, your land couldn't be divided. So that a lot of the guerrillas are sort of drawing on that and that interruption in 1954 with the coup to say we need to pick up this issue again, and also, you know, that indigenous peoples have been repressed, and that there is certainly communist propaganda amongst these, but it's not really, the Rios Montt specter is this is all Soviet controlled, right? That's sort of the Cold War motif amongst the elites and the right, is that this is an international communist movement, an international communist conspiracy. And it's really, well, no, we like these ideas, and some of us subscribe to Marx or to Che Guevara or to Mao, but this is our condition. Same with the FMLN, right? That they take their name from a guy who wanted reforms in the 30s, who'd gotten assassinated by the dictator then. That the Sandinistas, that Augusto Sandino is really this nationalist leader who ends up getting assassinated in help, thanks again once more to what becomes the CIA, effectively, the United States Army, or the Marines, rather. that each of these movements is really tapping into that history. That they're merging elements. I don't want to say they're not communist, because they are appealing to elements of it into some writings mm-hmm. from Marx or Lenin or Guevara or others or Castro. But that these are ultimately, I still think, more homegrown movements than... That I think the Shining Path is the most external, the one looking outwardly the most.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I guess the way that I would frame this, if I were to, you know, put it into one sentence, that many of these conflicts seem to have had the Cold War mapped over them, right? Mm-hmm. That the Cold War and Cold War ideological tensions, render these conflicts an easy template, or give an easy template for understanding these conflicts, not only to American policymakers, right, on the one hand, who sort of immediately see a right-wing government and see pro-capitalism and see its opponents as communists, but also in some extent even sort of give that template to the participants themselves, right?
Yeah.
And I don't know, you know, sort of the extent to which Rios Montt and others like him thought in terms of that, you know, we are simply using anti-communist rhetoric instrumentally, and the extent to which they actually sort of internalized that, right? They internalized that, and they really believe that they're fighting against international communism, which is, you know, a challenge to the church and to society. And,
yeah, to the nation. I mean, that's the language he always uses, that he saved the nation.
Right, right. We had a candidate in here at the Patterson School a few weeks ago, and I'll pitch this past you and see what you think. This candidate was making a comparative study of Brazilian and Chilean foreign policy, and was making the argument that differences in Chilean and Brazilian approaches to human rights and democratization, the issues of human rights and democratization in their foreign policy. First, that there are substantial differences, and that sort of Chile, since the transition, has been sort of starkly more supportive of issues, democratization, issues of human rights and so forth than the Brazilian government has. And that one of the reasons for that is that sort of Chilean Democrats have been attempting to stabilize Chilean democracy by creating as many connections that they have essentially been trying to lock in Chilean democracy by locking Chile into a whole variety of different transnational, non-governmental, various bilateral, multilateral commitments to democratic foreign policy, and in a way that the Brazilians really haven't been doing, right? The Brazilians have pursued a more of a realist foreign policy. Right. Does that argument resonate with you at all? Is that, if it does, is that something you can see in other places? To the extent you know anything about things like Guatemalan or Salvadoran foreign policy, do we see a pattern like that replicated? I don't know. What do you think of that argument?
I think that makes sense. I mean, I'm not trying to detract or belittle the argument. It sort of, not doesn't seem obvious, but yeah, it makes sense. But the reasons for that can be pretty, they go back to the democratization processes themselves, that in a number of ways, that Chile has this direct confrontation with its past in a way that Brazil does not, that Chile has a truth commission immediately afterwards and has this report from a former higher-up civilian in the dictatorship who sort of doesn't switch sides but realizes that these are pretty grotesque abuses and we need to investigate these and he issues this report. And, you know, that you have this truth commission hearings, and Brazil says, we just got to move on, that only now do they have this truth commission and it's not punitive. Brazil gets a new constitution out of its dictatorship. That in 1988, they sit down and say, we've got to write another one, because the one the military put in place, we can't leave. Chile does not. They're still operating with the constitution as it existed under Pinochet. And I would also even say just the size. Brazil is a country of 190 million people, and Chile is not.
Right.
That Brazil's trying to sort of become this regional hegemon, and sort of in that regard was a rival of Chavez, is Venezuela, a friendly rivalry. And not just a regional hegemon, but a global hegemon. I mean, the BRICS category is pretty useless, but Brazil has definitely tried to assert its power in the international arena that way, that it represents, you know, African countries before the World Trade Organization in a debate over cotton subsidies with the United States, that it's making arms deals, or not arms deals, oil deals with the Middle East, right? That as you said, it's sort of a more realist approach, but I think in part that's just because of sheer demography.
Regarding whether that translates to Central America, I mean, Central American politics are kind of a, they're not a weird thing per se compared, because that implies some norm, but that's certainly, the hold of the conservative oligarchs in Central America has been, I would say, stronger over politics and institutions for a number of reasons than it has in places like Brazil or Chile. That the size of the country themselves, the nature of their economies, industrialization processes, that Chile and Brazil are two of the countries that industrialized the most in the 20th century, whereas Central America generally does not. So I think you could actually, yeah, there are differences. I'm not trying to unify Central America in one thing, that El Salvador has a president from the FMLN now, that Nicaragua has reelected Daniel Ortega twice as the Sandinistas, that they returned to office to Democratic paths, while Guatemala has a general or former officer who is involved in these genocidal charges in office, right? So there is difference from one to the other, but I think generally speaking, you don't quite get this sense of global competition and sort of foreign relations, like of picking and choosing democracy over real politics, or, you know, sort of the real politics of the realistic politics of Brazil, because that they're El Salvador and Honduras, or Honduras and Guatemala, or whatever, look more similar than Chile and Brazil do.
Right.
Does that answer your question at all?
Yeah, no, I think it pretty much answers my question. So I want to get to something that we talked about in the last Evolve that we had, and that was we lost because of technical, and, you know, with the grace of God, we won't lose it because of technical issues this time. But last time we talked a bit about how sort of the rolling back of this wave of democratization, and as you point out, this very uneven wave of democratization that, through the 1980s and 1990s in Latin America, and sort of the notion that it's, or it is at least potentially being rolled back from two different directions, right? I mean, the one that, of course, Americans tend to be more familiar with is the sort of the rolling back from the left, where you have obviously Chavez, but you also have Morales to an extent in Bolivia, and other issues where or other places. And this is also very uneven and very, very twitchy territory,
right?
And involves sort of a lot of value judgments about Chavez's vision of democracy. But you have this on the one side, where at least norms of liberal institutional democracy are being rolled back in certain countries from the left, right? And whether those norms should be rolled back is a different question, right? Or, you know, who those norms support. But those norms certainly were rolled back by Chavez, and they were rolled back by people around Chavez. And then at the same time, you have a certain degree of rollback from the right, of which Honduras is the most obvious example, but, I mean, also to my understanding in Paraguay, you know, to an extent, I mean, people make arguments about Colombia too. You know, is this just, to your mind, I mean, first, what do you think of this thesis of rollback? And second, is this just sort of the natural give and take of national politics, right? Is this, should we not be thinking about this as any kind of wave? Is this just sort of natural tides moving back and, or natural tidal movement, if you will, of democratic institutions and their resilience in Latin America?
Sure. Regarding the first, I mean, it's curious because you mentioned those cases, and I still end up thinking, like, but that's such a minority, right? Yeah, you have Paraguay, that you have Honduras, that you have Guatemala, although, again, Honduras and Guatemala haven't exactly taken what would most be called a progressive path by any stretch of the imagination. But that, yeah, you know, Maduro, I mean, God knows what will happen in Venezuela going forward, but at the moment, Maduro is in power. That you still have Uruguay, Chile, you know, yeah, Chile has a conservative win, but it's not looking good for conservatives for next year's presidential elections, that the Concertación could take office again. You still have Brazil, you have, like you said, Ecuador, Bolivia. It's striking because, it does sort of seem like there's been this right-wing rollback, but then when you look at the actual leaders of the countries, they're still a minority in Latin America, and even Juan Manuel Santos isn't as conservative as Uribe had been. But I do think that is partly the ebb and flow of politics, national politics. And I think the other curious thing is, and then again to sort of stretch this to hemispheric relations, is one of the arguments that always annoys me the most, and it's fortunately dying away a bit, is that, but you saw it really around 2008, 2009, was that, oh wow, Latin America is doing really well in spite of the United States not paying attention to it for about a decade here, with sort of since 9/11. And the thing that was so frustrating wasn't that the in spite of, right? It's like it's not because of, right. In spite of, it's because of. That basically these ideas, right. Of democratization that they had often tried to impose for decades, but had always been interrupted by the United States, are finally given an 8-10 year laboratory to work, and it turns out they're working. That institutional democracy is relatively healthy, even while you're seeing some reduction in social inequalities and socioeconomic, right. Inequalities. And I think now what we're seeing is even with people like Sebastian Piñera in Chile, or Juan Manuel Santos, who again I wouldn't categorize necessarily as right wing, but it's certainly not one of these part of that, you know, so-called new left. The challengers in Brazil, even in Paraguay, well, Paraguay might be the outlier here, that you're seeing sort of a right in this post-successful era of the left. In that regard, Paraguay really does stand out because they've only had one real progressive president, and that was Lugo, who, of course, was overthrown in this institutional coup where they impeach him on the flimsiest of charges, and it's not clear it violated what they charged him with was actually constitutional. The question, right. Of giving him 24 hours to prepare his defense and no more is dubious constitutionally. So what you're seeing is just the return to power of a party that had been in power with Stroessner, effectively. The dictatorship of Stroessner from 54 to 89 that had the Colorado Party's complicity involved in Congress, and that's who's in charge now. But even Paraguay is a bit weird because you have this guy who's elected and he's finally apologized for horrifically homophobic comments. He's made some racist comments in the past as well, but that he had no background in politics, that this was his first election to any office whatsoever. So that's kind of a weird moment in terms of this turn of the right. And I really do think it's just this sort of ebb and flow of national politics. And perhaps Paraguay, to bring it back to him again, is strangely a perfect example of this because he won, and a lot of people were still angry that Lugo was overthrown, but they basically said, this guy has done nothing in politics, but has been successful in business, and we won't focus on whether that success is due to drug smuggling or other contraband across the border. But you know what? He hasn't been in politics before. Let's see if he can fix this mess. Because the ones, right. Who have been in politics have it. And the one guy we did elect, they overthrew him, so we'll try this one instead.
Right. I don't know. I mean, was there anything else you wanted to add? I think it's been a good conversation, but is there anything else?
No, I mean, I guess one thing I would add, and maybe I referred to this before, but just, I guess to bring it back to where we started, I would really highly emphasize the symbolic value of this genocide conviction. Right? A lot of people said, right. Well, maybe this will provide instruction to the world, and maybe it will, but maybe it won't, right? That this is the first case of its kind, so whether this becomes a trendsetter or was an isolated instance, only time will tell. But it really does speak volumes that even though the Guatemalan judicial system in general is still, you know, how this is going to shake out there is questionable, that's a big step in terms of these sort of institutional authorities that you have the president himself, who is probably sweating a little bit now, saying that this was the right, you know, that he supports the court's decision, that he's going to sort of respect the institutional autonomy of the court system. And I think it really does kind of, every time you get one of these convictions or even indictments, whether it was Pinochet in Chile, whether it was the Argentine generals in the 80s and again now after this amnesty of the 1990 was overthrown, whether it's Alberto Fujimori in Peru, whether now it's Rios Montt in Guatemala, every time you get a conviction or a case like this, I think it's an important step toward that democratization because it's a reminder it shows more and more that heads of state can't really fall back on these defenses of saving the nation or of I was just a governor and I knew nothing about this. I was just trying to do my job.
Right.
And I think ultimately, I mean, especially when you look at Latin American national history, the abuses of power from the executive branch dating back to the national era had so often gone unpunished that I think this really does sort of establish an important, it adds to what's already an important precedent that simultaneously discourages this kind of behavior going forward, I hope, and strengthens the democratic institutions as they exist now, right? That this is why we need to keep these electoral systems in place, is because that's the alternative, and look where this ends up.
So, is there a next case we should be looking forward to, whether in Guatemala or in some other country, right? I mean, is there a next, not really another shooter drop, but, you know, what's the next step in this process? You know, eventually we're going to reach a point where everybody's dead, right? But you know, who else are we looking at, and where else are we looking at procedures of this sort that that we can say this is the next thing, this is the next big thing that's going to happen here?
Well, I don't know that they will happen, but places you could mm-hmm. look, certainly the stench of paramilitaries around Juan Uribe, around Uribe is enormous, right? That they've repeatedly mm-hmm. been tied to his top aides, his family members, congressmen who worked with him. He's escaped yet, but that ring keeps shrinking and shrinking. Now, that's not to say he'll get charged with anything, but mm-hmm. the evidence mm-hmm. is increasingly mounting that he's probably connected to paramilitaries to some degree. The question, Guatemala itself, I mean, that's another issue about this conviction. Is this the end of these prosecutions in Guatemala, or is this the beginning of these prosecutions? You know, what happens mm-hmm. to the current president, Otto Perez Molina, who was a commanding officer in the Ixtal Triangle, where all of these genocidal campaigns are taking place that Rios Montt was just convicted of? He was operating, there's video footage of him from the 80s, where he's on the ground around dead bodies talking about how they're stamping out communism. He's immune now as president, but what happens to him when he leaves office? Are they going to
Right.
That you have the elites in Guatemala saying, well, we just need to move on, you know, which is a common refrain amongst those who supported these regimes. Brazil, that you have the Truth Commission going, and it doesn't have punitive powers, but you're still having a lot of former officers who are still alive sweating a lot as they have to testify. And that just yesterday, one gave a testimony saying that, well, the current president, Dilma Rousseff, wanted to establish a communist regime in this country, right? That still resonates with current politics. And it's not like the end of these dictatorships has led to the end of police violence. That if anything, it's intensified in places like Brazil. The operation of, you know, the Paraguayan case that led to Lugo's ouster, you had a bunch of dead civilians, and they charged a bunch of civilians quickly, but not a single police officer was charged. So I think that there's sort of two ways to look at this. It's first is, who else has been tied to these crimes in the past? But the second, and perhaps more important one, and not to lose sight of, is the fact that this type of state violence hasn't disappeared just because the sort of Cold War map that you mentioned has.
And
to what degree do you try to continue to push towards these more social democracies in the sense of the state can't operate with such impunity any longer? And I really think that's sort of the arenas in which to look at now.
All right. Well, Colin, thanks very much. It's been fantastic.
Thank you very much once again.
All right.
Okay.
And for entertainment viewers, thank you so much for watching.